Hello and welcome everybody to another episode of the Mile End Institute podcast coming to you from Queen Mary University of London. Today we are very pleased to be able to welcome Giles Edwards, who is a broadcaster, author and journalist. He's produced and presented documentaries for BBC Radio 4, World Service and Radio 3, ranging from news and current affairs to science and the arts. He's written three previous books, including Boris versus Ken and British Politics Unraveled. But today we're going to be talking to him about his latest book, which is called X-Men. And it's all about how our former presidents and prime ministers are still changing the world. And it's published by Biteback. Welcome, Giles.
Thanks very much for having me, Tim.
Okay, well, thanks very much for coming on. So perhaps we could start by you just telling our listeners a little bit about how you got interested in this particular subject.
Yeah, well, I've always been interested in what happens when people stop having all the power. It always seems to me that the people who got to the very top of politics, who climbed Disraeli's greasy pole, have a whole series of qualities, you know, luck, ambition, skills, whether that's public speaking or interpersonal skills, policy expertise, all of things, health, which get them to the top. And of course, they don't desert them the day after they leave office. They don't have them one day and then not have them the next. And so I was always been interested in, well, what do they do with all those skills? One of the reasons I call the book The X-Men is I kind of refer to them a bit as superpowers, a bit like Marvel's superheroes. What are they? What are they doing with them? And how is it affecting the rest of us?
Well, we'll come on to some individuals later, but I wondered if you could just tell our listeners a little bit about, you know, what you refer to at one stage as these sort of club consultancies, these groups of X-Men and women, as you very rightly point out. Could you just go through the various clubs that are around and tell us a little bit about what they do and perhaps even a little bit about how they differ from each other, how they specialise?
Yeah, absolutely. And just thanks for picking up on the women thing as well. I know some people have said, why the X-Men? Surely there are former female presidents and prime ministers. And of course there are. I'm afraid the title The X-Men and a reference to the Marvel superheroes was just too appealing to give up. But there are definitely lots of women in the book. And let's start with one of them, Mary Robinson, who runs, she's chair of the Elders, which is one of these club consultancies. It was originally set up by Nelson Mandela. And there's four or five of the main ones. The Elders, I think, is one of the more interesting. The aim of all of them, I think, in a way, is the same, which is to use the combined power of former presidents and prime ministers. One former prime minister, Paul Martin, the Canadian prime minister, said to me that he could achieve more in one day in power as prime minister than he could in a month afterwards. And they're all, to varying extents, aware of this. But when they come together, they all think they can do more. And I think they're right about that. So the club consultancies are an effort to do that and to take advantage of varying different skill sets that they have. So some of them are to do with public campaigning. And the Elders did that very interestingly. I had a great conversation with Mary Robinson about this, where they did a lot of public campaigning on the issue of child marriage. And the Elders identify this as an issue which cut across lots of the existing work that was going on in amongst NGOs and governments in developing countries to do with maternal health, to do with kids in education, to do with all sorts of other questions, the empowerment of women. They identified this as a cross-cutting issue, but nobody was really paying attention to it. And so the Elders came together and they did kind of two or three things. First was they hooked up with a bunch of funders to make sure there was funding available. Secondly, they informed themselves about it and did a lot of public advocacy about it. And thirdly, they went to meetings of global current leaders. They went to the UN and they went to the Clinton Global Initiative. And they said, this is something you should be spending your time on. Well, when Mary Robinson and Jimmy Carter and Desmond Tutu and Graça Machel all say that at the same time, it does have a really important effect, making a lot of people think, well, they're all saying it, maybe we should be doing something about this. And that's what happened, in fact. Tons of money went in, tons of action happened. They did lots of work with grassroots organisations and they set up a kind of a legacy NGO to take that work forward. So that's a kind of emblematic of the work that the Elders does. Quite a lot in public, quite a lot of using their public profile. The second, I think, really interesting one is the Global Leadership Foundation, set up by another former South African president, F.W. de Klerk. And if The Elders has something of Mandela's DNA, the publicity, the global statesman thing about it, the GLF has something of de Klerk's DNA. Still global statesman, but quiet, behind the scenes, wanted to do things effectively, but to do it really, really, really quietly away from the limelight. And they're kind of caught in a little bit of a bind here, because one of the reasons they were keen to talk to me is they do want people to know what they do and that they exist. But on the other hand, their model is really, really different from The Elders. So their model is essentially peer-to-peer advice for the most senior leaders in the world. So the idea is that if you've just been elected president and you've got some intractable problem and you are a bit isolated in government, perhaps you've worried that people around you are a bit corrupt or whatever it may be, or you just don't have the expertise in your country, you can ring up the GLF. And I imagine this is kind of F.W. de Klerk sitting in a leather armchair somewhere in South Africa, and he gets a call and they say, "Oh, F.W., I've got a problem with water policy or something." And he sort of flicks through his Rolodex. And in his Rolodex is everyone from Helen Clark, the former New Zealand Prime Minister who went on to run the UN Development Programme, to a whole host of other people. And essentially he finds somebody who's a really good match, both in terms of the policy expertise, but also the type of country. And essentially they go over and they advise them. They do it completely under the radar. There's no publicity unless the leader wants publicity, in which case they're welcome to have it, but mostly they don't. And they're there only to support that person. They're not there, they don't come with some other agenda. They're not paid for their work other than a small per diem. And the idea is this very intense value that these former leaders have, all this expertise they've developed in the service of current leaders. And then there are a couple other organisations, the Interaction Council, which is much more, I would say, much more of a club, and they talk about things and they issue declarations. And then there's the Club of Madrid, which is the largest actually of them all, and tends more towards large seminars and big set piece events where they get a bunch of former presidents and prime ministers, X-Men as I call them, and policy experts, and they have several days of dialogue. So quite a lot of opportunities for people to get involved in these club consultancies.
There was one thing you touched on that I think some people might be interested in, and you know, particularly those of a more perhaps conspiratorial cast of mind, which is, where do they get their money from, these organisations?
Well, the organisations get their money from a variety of different ways. The GLF and the Elders, which are the sort of the largest, in terms of membership and I think really impact, they both have quite kind of interesting funding models. The Elders has a very stable group, about 10 or 12 large funders. They're typically large NGOs or family foundations or wealthy individuals. Richard Branson was one of the founders of the Elders, and there's a bunch of family foundations. So they've got very stable, and they each give quite a significant amount of money each year, but in a very stable way over quite a lot of years. The Global Leadership Foundation has sort of the same but the reverse, which is that they don't want anyone to give them lots of money. They want stable donorship as well, but they want smaller amounts so that they can never be seen to be partisan or partial. But they also take money from the corporate world. So whereas the Elders seems much more kind of NGO land, the GLF rather is happy to get involved in the corporate world. And I think they do this quite advisedly in a way which I think is quite interesting. So as you say, a conspiracy theory minded person might think, well, that's dodgy. They're taking this money from mining companies and so on, and they do. Their argument is a different one, which is that actually when they have their annual shindig, the senior people from these companies come and they share intelligence about where there are opportunities to do good work. They're very clear about not taking up a lead where it appears there's some commercial advantage to one of their donors, but they definitely take advantage of the kind of intelligence from their wider world. And when I talked to the chief executive, Sir Robert Fulton, about this, I was a little sceptical of this, and I thought, well, you know, how careful really are you, or can you be? And he was slightly disarming in that he said, and I'm sure you've read this in the book, actually it happened last week. we had to say no to somebody. I didn't feel comfortable with that, so we said no to it. And I think it's relatively unusual to hear a chief executive talk in those terms.
Now, you've talked us through the club consultancies, but you know, there's a focus on individuals as well. And you start the book with Jimmy Carter, for example, and in some ways he is the kind of ultimate example, because yeah, he's been doing it for so long and in so many different ways. But you also mention, obviously, Bill Clinton as well. That prompts a question, which is, does whatever a president or a prime minister has done during their working life, as it were, as a politician, make any difference either to what they do afterwards as an X-man or a woman, or to their effectiveness as such. In other words, is this an opportunity for some people to, as it were, rescue their reputations?
Yes and yes. I mean, it definitely has an effect, the role that you play in public life. And there's no question about that. People who have kind of soiled their reputations find it very difficult to recover. And it might be surprising for people to hear that, bearing in mind Jimmy Carter's relative lack of success as a president and relative success as a former president. He's widely kind of lauded for what he's done since leaving office. And just for you know, for the listeners who aren't familiar with the ins and outs of Jimmy Carter's post-presidency, two or three big things really. The first is he's done a massive amount in kind of election monitoring. He was the first former president of the United States to get involved in that. And in the very early days of that happening, when democracies were spreading around the world, it started at a time in the mid-80s when there weren't that many democracies. You know, we're used to a largely democratic world now. Large parts of the world were not kind of replete with democracy in that era. And countries started democratizing, Carter was very involved in election monitoring, assuring the international community, but also providing reassurance internally that, you know, there's a former president of the United States here, let's tamp down the funny business. Secondly, on tropical diseases, he's been really involved in tackling so-called neglected tropical diseases. And Carter's mantra here is that tropical diseases are neglected because the people themselves are neglected. But he has been unbelievably successful in this endeavor. I mean, really staggeringly so. And in particular, in relation to Guinea worm disease, which is this horrible disease where it was really endemic in large parts of the world in the mid-80s when he started. And in the last couple of years, the total number of cases has fallen from something like 300 million when he started work to something like 18. And that's 18 full stop. It's absolutely astonishing. And I guess the third thing he's done is in relation to kind of affordable housing. He's been very involved in an American NGO called Habitat for Humanity, where he builds every year, he does a so-called Jimmy Carter work project where they build houses essentially. And the sight of a former American president pitching up in kind of pretty low income, let's put it, neighborhoods in the Philippines or in India or in New York City, which is the first one that he did, really transformed the idea of what a former president could do and also what was appropriate work for people to get involved with, for people to support. So he's been enormously influential. The thing that I think is super interesting about this at a kind of macro level is that people look at him and say, well, how surprising that he should be so successful in all these endeavours when he was relatively unsuccessful as a president. I would say his presidency was absolutely crucial to understanding all of these endeavours, in that his relationships of trust that he built in Latin America, for example, were absolutely crucial to the early election monitoring. His consistent championing of human rights have really enabled him to be an effective advocate of the election monitoring and the neglected tropical diseases work. You know, his work on low-income neighbourhoods and housing and urban development in the United States during his presidency gave him a space to do that after his presidency with Habitat for Humanity. So it's completely wrapped up. And there's no question in my mind that one couldn't have happened without the other.
And I mean, what about Clinton? Do you think he's been as much of a success or could be in the future? Because presumably he's got a little bit longer, let's be honest, than Jimmy Carter.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. Yeah, I mean, I think Clinton left office under that cloud, didn't he? And not only the Lewinsky cloud, but with his kind of slightly unseemly pardons that he gave out to fugitive financier on his way out the door. And lots of people looked at him and said, what a waste. What's he going to do now? And actually what he did then was he set up, aside from setting up a foundation and a library, which all the former presidents do, and we'll no doubt see that from President Trump when he leaves office, he set up a whole kind of NGO world, the Clinton Foundation, which certainly in the early days, he had this thing called the Clinton Global Initiative. I mentioned it earlier in relation to the elders. And really, essentially what it was a bringing together of everybody in global philanthropy. It was the hottest ticket in town. And it was an era where somebody coined the phrase philanthrocapitalism. Everybody wanted, you know, they'd earned their gazillions in hedge funds or wherever they'd earned it. And they wanted to figure out how they could do some good in the world. And the Clinton Global Initiative really was at the centre of that. And the premise was really quite simple. You came along, you announced an absolute ton of money going into some project or other. You pledged to deliver some identifiable public good, and then you'd be held to account for it. And the deal was really simple. If you didn't cough up the cash, you never got invited back. It was like the ultimate black mark that nobody in that world wanted to get against their name, and everybody wanted to go. And it was very, very successful. And Clinton himself did a lot of very interesting work. You know, he was a very attractive person for lots of people to want to be involved with. He used that ability to bring people together. He did some big deals about AIDS medicine in particular in sub-Saharan Africa, which I think were very, very consequential. But all that just began to change after 2008, and particularly after 2016, when his wife ran for the presidency and then was Secretary of State and then ran for the presidency again. And all of a sudden, an organisation which had seemed just taking tons of money from people and squirting it towards a variety of good causes, all of a sudden people started looking at some of that money and going, huh, who are these people? Might they ask for favours if she's Secretary of State? Or might they ask for favours if she's president? And so what had been a tremendous asset to kind of the Clinton brand became a little bit of a liability. And, you know, they definitely still have a bunch of activities. The Clinton University, which is supposed to be in Edinburgh this year, but had to be online instead. He's still a tremendous draw. They did that event online in the height of the pandemic. The governors of both California and New York State, the two hotspots of the coronavirus pandemic at that point, still took half an hour, 45 minutes out of their schedule to come and talk to Bill Clinton. So he's still an enormous draw. But I think that central role he played in a certain part of the NGO world has inevitably disappeared a little bit.
And if we look at British prime ministers, I mean, how do you think their efforts have contrasted with each other? You know, if you had to sort of pick who was the more successful between Gordon Brown, who you do write about quite a lot, actually, in the book, and Tony Blair, who would you pick?
It's a really difficult question to answer for this reason, that influence is the hardest thing to measure. Even when we're writing a political history, and, you know, I was at Queen Mary, I did all my study with the great Peter Hennessy. All of that stuff I learned about all benefits of oral history and how to examine documents. And we all understand how difficult it is to disentangle what actually happened, how to get to the truth of it. That's super hard when you're talking about international organisations where there certainly aren't. Open documents requests. There's no FOI, there's no mandatory publication. None of these people have to give interviews to the media unless they want to. I mean, nobody does anyway, but there's an understanding that if you're in government, you sort of are expected to. So it's enormously difficult to understand what goes on behind the scenes. So Blair has been both criticised and lauded for his post-premiership, criticised really for where he took some of his money from. And I think that criticism, you can look at that criticism up, some of the places he took money from, are eyebrow raising, I think. But the question is, what did he spend that money on? And what he spent it on is a variety of work, largely now focused in Africa, where he does sort of a little bit what I was describing the Global Leadership Foundation doing, except he's much more embedded. So he has relationships in a bunch of African governments where his advisors work quite closely with usually the Office of the Presidency, or sometimes the Public Health Office, or some other part of the public sector, to kind of give some of Blair's advice, Blair's expertise, to countries which perhaps don't have the civil service infrastructure or the history or the expertise on some particular policy question that we do in this country. But how do you assess that influence? Blair as well went off to do this role for the Quartet in the Middle East, where again he was criticised for his failure to do things that weren't part of his mandate, but also, you know, caught up, had a limited mandate in a situation where external factors, I think, made it enormously difficult to achieve more than he achieved. Nevertheless, criticised for that. Gordon Brown, on the other hand, has taken a very different line, which is he's gone full square into that international world. And as you say, rightly, I write about this in the book a bit, he chaired this global study group, essentially on the financing of education, identified this colossal gap as a wave of young people come through in lower and middle income countries. How on earth are we going to educate them properly to be ready for the challenges of the next millennium? And identified this enormous gap, brought all of the great and the good of the global education world into that. Many of his former presidents and prime ministers, his fellow X-Men, and then didn't really say very much about how it was going to be filled. It just said tax and this little bit, which we're going to fill with some loans. So in that sense, it's a different kind of don't know, which is, remains to be seen, don't know, as to how influential he's going to be. But I think in both of their cases, they are listened to for their successes in office. Brown also listened to on global finance questions because of his role in the financial crisis. Blair, in other respects, because of his success, really, you know, as a very long-serving prime minister who saw and did a lot in office.
I mean, that is interesting because that does raise the question of the extent to which, you know, one's performance in office actually makes a difference to one's ability to influence. I mean, it's very interesting, just as an aside, you do talk in the book about, I think you call it remunerative reminiscence, in other words, speech or lecture circuit that X-Men do go on and do get paid for. And one of the very interesting things about that is that it doesn't actually matter very much about whether you were considered a successful president or prime minister. In terms of how much you can earn on that. And you quote at length somebody on François Hollande, for example, who wasn't necessarily seen as the greatest president that France had ever seen. But he's very flexible and amenable and affable and actually does well on that circuit. And of course, we've seen recently Theresa May do pretty well as well. And she's not even a completely ex-man since she's still an MP. But actually, we've talked a lot about men so far. And as you say in the book, or, you know, despite the title, there are a lot of women who feature in this. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit, and this is my bias, really, because I've got dual New Zealand British citizenship, about Helen Clark. You know, you describe her at one point as a kind of force of nature, this kind of intense, you know, very successful X-Man. Let us know a little bit about what she does.
Yeah, I find her one of the most interesting people I spoke to. And I've met her at the Global Leadership Foundation annual shindig. And, you know, it's an interesting event that where all of these people, they're all kind of the same level. So it's not like you've got a bunch of sort of junior people and then some very senior people and everyone's very excited to meet them. And so they don't have kind of anything to prove. And yet Helen Clark, for me at least, completely stood out. She was constantly on. She'd go out in a coffee break and other people would wander over. Some of them would be kind enough to come have a chat with me. Others would be chatting to each other or chatting to one of these people from one of these organisations which funds it. And Helen Clark would go off and do a kind of FaceTime with her grandkids, or she'd speak to her, do an interview with a radio station in somewhere. In the plenaries, she's constantly searching around. She always had something to say which was very interesting, on point, added to the discussion. She's involved in this enormous variety of organisations. I'll be honest, I was really surprised by that. One of my kind of theses, if there's a thesis under this, is that maybe if you kind of concentrate your effort onto one or two or three things, that's probably a more productive use of your time. You can't do everything like you can when you're in, and you have to when you're in government, because how does that have any effect? Yeah, Helen Clark completely rejected that. She said, no, I maintain a portfolio. And she kind of went through this portfolio and she described it to me. It took about 3 minutes to describe the portfolio of issues she's still engaged with. And her view was really simple, that there's no point in her getting down in the weeds in some issue or other. She's got beyond that point. She will get involved with if she thinks she can make some difference, where she can add something. I think for me, that really is the mark of a successful and interesting X-Man or organisation. The reason when you asked the question about the club consultancies, I started with the elders is, and then went on to the GLF, is I think both of them have a really clear idea of what it is that they can do specifically as a club for X-Men, not as another NGO just doing stuff, but how they can take the specific qualities and stuff that they've got and take advantage of it. So they have this quite elaborate theory of change on the website, which essentially involves the X-Men can get access in the way that other NGOs can't. And Helen Clark, I think, has this very same view. I don't think I'm sure she doesn't have a published theory of change. But she has she's been in politics. She's a very successful Prime Minister of New Zealand for quite a long time. She then went on to be the second highest ranking person in the UN after the Secretary General, where she went around and was a very senior figure speaking to governments of every level, having enormous knowledge of all these countries all around the world. She has a very good politician sense of when something is achievable and when it's not. And so she uses that sense all the time to think, well, do I care about this? Yes. Do I think there's something I can do about this? Yeah, at the margins. Okay, I'll do it. And in fact, the guy you mentioned who works with these people and getting them speeches was kind of torn when I asked him about Helen Clark, because he represents her. And he said, well, it's frustrating because I'd really like to get her to do more speeches, but she spends all her time doing all this other stuff. And she's the real deal. He was a real admirer of hers for that reason, that she really is very clear about what it is that she wants to achieve and how she's going to achieve it. Now, we can still go back to the earlier question. Does she achieve it? Does she make the difference? I think that's an enormously difficult question to ask. But I also think, in terms of particularly this lobbying and so on, companies, organisations spend an enormous and inordinate amount of time and money and effort trying to get into the room where the decision is taken, into the Prime Minister's office or the presidential suite or where, or the C-suite of some company. We have to assume that these X-Men and women, that is valuable. Their ability to get into the room, to speak to the person who's making the decision, is of some value. And I talked to several of them about it, about this, and they all said there's no good just getting there. It's no good knowing about stuff, having knowledge it was 5 years old. You've got to absolutely know what it is you can do. But the fact that they can get into that room consistently, they all talk about this, that we have to assume that they're making a difference when they're in there.
I mean, Helen Clark is an interesting one, and Mary Robinson's an interesting one, yeah. Because does your ability to get into the room depend to some extent on which country it was you governed? Now, I ask this because sometimes it strikes me that actually heads of countries like New Zealand, and you talk about some other New Zealand ex-prime ministers, yeah. But also you mention Ireland and Portugal, in some ways have an advantage in the sense that their states are not seen as threatening and are not seen necessarily to have played a particularly huge global role in particular conflicts. And that in some ways makes it easier for them to do this stuff than it does perhaps for people who come from states and who have governed states that have, let's say, got themselves into more trouble on the world stage.
I think that's definitely true. I think your analysis is spot on. What really interested me about what Helen Clark said is she said it particularly at multilateral organisations. So that's both intergovernmental or formal organisations and NGOs. That's particularly true there. And she's really interesting about why. She thinks it's because, you know, as a leader of a smaller country, you're not used to bossing things around. You're used to a more conciliatory style of leadership. You're used to having to work with people. And that's what you have to do in a multilateral context. And so whether it's the UN or the EU or NATO, we can think of prime ministers and presidents from, you know, Portugal and, you know, New Zealand and Chile and Denmark and Norway and Luxembourg who and Poland, who've run these organizations, not any of them the largest, most powerful countries in the world. Nevertheless, you know, former British prime ministers, former French presidents, former American presidents do have that ability. And if you're Nelson Mandela, bluntly, if you have some kind of either major country behind you, that does give you a possibility to project in a greater way outside of those multilateral frameworks, I think. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see Chinese former presidents, premiers tend to not have done this, and neither do Indians. Nigerians do a little bit more. And I speak to President Obasanjo of Nigeria, who's a particularly interesting figure and has a kind of a big role in Southern Africa and elsewhere in Africa. But yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. The country you come from, your record in office, but also those personal qualities, it's the intersection between those three which will really determine your success as an X-Man.
You've talked a little bit about some African X-Men, and you've also talked about how important it is for these club consultancies to pick the right person for the right mission. It's obviously very important when you're dealing with some of the conflicts in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, that people aren't sent as kind of white saviours. So could you tell us a little bit about some of the African X-Men that you talked to?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is it's a really important point. And African X-Men have a particular kind of burden of responsibility placed on them, which is Africa is a continent with enormous opportunities and potential, but also enormous challenges. And so there's more of an expectation that they will get involved regionally, either within the specific part of Africa that they're from or more widely. And so I spoke to a couple. John Kafur is a particularly interesting character, former a Ghanaian president who's been very involved in lots of different ways, in lots of kind of post-conflict or conflict resolution. And then with Festus Mogae, former Botswanan president, who likewise has done the same. And there's a plethora of wisdom amongst these former heads of state and government, these African X-Men. And very wisely, both international organisations, countries involved in kind of bilateral disagreements, and then international organisations just wanting an African perspective on bigger questions. So John Kafur was a climate change envoy for the United Nations. You know, are really keen and happy to use these X-Men to make arguments to African leaders. And I spoke to John Kafur about his role as a UN climate change special envoy of the Secretary General, these unbelievably convoluted titles. And there's a lot of them now. Ban Ki-moon, the last Secretary General, was a particularly prolific appointer of special representatives. And I was interested in what they actually did. And really, essentially, it comes back to what I said before. It's the ability to get in the room and speak kind of face to face at a same level with a sitting president. When I asked John Kafur whether he has to kind of gin himself up on all the ins and outs of climate policy, he said, well, he did get taken away for this unbelievable session where he got kind of rammed full of information about climate change. He said his head felt a bit kind of swooning at the end of it. But really, he said his current presidents and prime ministers know all of that. They have advisors who can tell them all the details about what their GDP or what climate change or some, you know, weather change is, effect is having on their country. What they need is him. His role is to come and say, can you come yourself, Mr. President or Madam President? Can you come to this meeting? Can you be present personally? You know, this is the greatness of your country is on the line here. It's to make that political argument and connect politically. And I think, again, that's the other thing that it's easy to forget about what X-Men have that so other lobbyists or international organisations don't have. And just stepping away from Africa for a minute, but I'm absolutely certain this is true for John Kafur and Festus Mogae as much as it is for John Bruton. When I talked to John Bruton, who is a European Union's ambassador to the United States, we talked about the business of talking to members of Congress. He really prioritised speaking to members of Congress. And he said, there's definitely a connection. We've all been in this very risky, high-stakes game of elective politics. We all know we could lose office next time around. And so you're speaking to each other as equals. You understand each other in a way that, however good, and there are many good ones, the head of an NGO is, they can never quite appreciate elective politics in the same way, I think, as when you've done it yourself. And so that's the final way, I think, in which they're able to connect with current heads of state in government, the current decision makers, is that knowledge that I've sat there, I've been there, I know what it is a little bit to feel like what you're feeling, whether that's the uncertainty, the fear, the trepidation, the excitement, the opportunity. They've sat there, they've been there, they've done that.
Well, perhaps it would be a job for an X-Man or a bunch of X-Men to go to the White House now and persuade Donald Trump that he may have a future after presidency if he desires to give it up. But for the moment, I'd like to say thank you very much, Giles. It's a really great book if anyone's interested in world affairs more generally, but also in what prime ministers and presidents do after they step down. If you've enjoyed listening to this episode, then please do subscribe to the MEI podcast. And if you do subscribe, please do rate us. Please tell your friends about us too. You can also sign up to our mailing list for information about future events, which is on our website. And you can also find there our blog. And you can find us too on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. So it only remains for me to say thanks once again to Giles, and thanks also to Sophia Cassano for producing. And we'll see you next time.